Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 3rd of May. We're going to spend this hour looking specifically at how the United States will proceed in the war on terror now that the number one most wanted terrorist has been killed. While bin Laden's demise was greeted with triumph by millions in the United States and around the world, analysts expressed concern that al-Qaeda may seek retaliation. So how will the U.S. move on and continue to monitor terrorist activities overseas while keeping our borders safe? We'll have two guests with us this hour to try and answer those questions. Robert Haddock will join us, managing editor of Small Wars Journal, who also writes This Week at War, a column for Foreign Policy magazine. And Mary Habeck will join us, associate professor in the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. We'll welcome your phone calls, as we always do. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address, talk@wpr.org. Robert Haddock is managing editor of Small Wars Journal, writing This Week at War column for Foreign Policy, and is a member of the Small Wars Journal management team. He was an officer in the U.S. Marine Corps, serving in the 3rd Marine Regiment, deployed with a Marine Amphibious Unit, and participating in many exercises with host nation military forces in Asia and in Africa. He was a staff officer in the 1st Battalion, 12th Marines, and selected for the personnel reliability program relating to command and control duties, later commanded a rifle company in the 23rd Marine Regiment. He writes frequently for The American, published by the American Enterprise Institute, and has written for the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Air and Space Power, and a number of other publications. He earned his degrees from the University of Illinois, so he has Midwestern roots as well. Robert Haddock, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Because you have such a strong military background, and because many of us are just poring over the maps and looking at what happened at that compound, can you describe what it must have taken for this military accomplishment to be so successful? It is just extraordinary, I think.
Well, yes, it is an extraordinary accomplishment. It's a team effort. It involves coordination by a wide variety of organizations, units, helicopter pilots, communications people, intelligence analysts, and at the end of the chain there are the shooters themselves. It's thought to be Navy SEALs who are specialists in these direct action raids.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of moving parts, and it takes a lot of practice and rehearsal to get these operations to work properly.
Right. And then a matter of hoping that Osama bin Laden is in that compound, too. So there was an element of, we got to do this, but we're not completely sure.
Yes. These high-profile direct action raids like this do not have a very good history to them. Some of us recall the Operation Eagle Claw in April 1980, the attempt during the Carter administration to rescue American diplomatic staff being held at the embassy in Tehran.
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of a pickup team effort, and so the United States has worked in the decades since to have, you know, regular standing forces that specialize in this, work together constantly. And, of course, over the past 10 years, the Joint Special Operations Command that specializes in these direct action raids, they've gotten a lot of experience.
What did you think when you saw this? In the day or so since this event, when we've learned more, did you say to yourself, well, this is what America usually can do? Or did you say this was just extraordinary that this all came together? There was an element of luck involved in it. What'd you think?
Well, yes, there is an element of luck on several different levels. First, with these operations, there's a lot more that can go wrong than go right, and so it's good that that it went as smoothly as it did. The other element of luck is that the target in question, Bin Laden, was actually there. So many other times when the United States has conducted raids like this, for one reason or another, they've come up with a dry hole, and that didn't happen in this case. So there's always an element of luck involved. Your planning, preparation, of course, tries to turn luck in your favor, the skill exhibited by both the intelligence community and analysts and the operators, showed that they were able to minimize the chance element to a very low degree.
Mm-hmm. I know that Small Wars Journal has published a list of the status of al-Qaeda leaders. Give us a sort of an overview of what the status is, how successful we have been in capturing some of these leaders or in taking them out.
Well, the al-Qaeda organization is in great flux, what its future will be, who will be in the leadership. It's a rapidly changing situation for them, and I'm sure that there's going to be a lot of confusion internally in al-Qaeda in that regard. There have been numerous captures, as you say, over the past 10 years. The people that have been most vulnerable to capture have been the ones that have had to interface with the wider world, and this is how they attempted to protect Bin Laden over the past 10 years, is by having a clean break between, as clean a break as they could manage, between keeping Bin Laden sheltered from any contact with the outside world, so he'd be hard to track down. So the notorious number three man in Al Qaeda might have been the most dangerous position to have, and he was. Nobody survived in that job very long, because that's the guy that had to interface with the rest of the world, and when he did that, he made himself vulnerable to capture. Now, in this particular case, one of these couriers slipped up with respect to his communications, and U.S. intelligence community was able to trace him back to Bin Laden's location.
Mm-hmm. We were talking about other people to be on the watch for part of last hour's program. Would you agree that al-Zawahiri is the number two guy who essentially would now be in charge of al-Qaeda and has made an announcement to that effect? Has he?
Not to my knowledge. That doesn't mean that he hasn't. I'm just not aware of it. John Brennan, President Obama's counterterrorism advisor, in his press conference yesterday, made an interesting point about Zawahiri, and that is that he is he does not have the prestige or the charisma that Bin Laden had in some circles. That he's divisive figure within the al-Qaeda organization, and that his continued presence there is likely to, in Brennan's view, cause the remaining al-Qaeda inner circle to get into more bickering and fracturing.
Mm-hmm. And how do you imagine, you know these workings of these organizations, how do other members in al-Qaeda, other leadership, what do you think they're thinking about the death of their charismatic leader, who we've been looking for 10 years?
Well, it must make them extremely nervous. I'm sure that the remnants of the al-Qaeda high command or inner circle, such as it is, they're scrambling right now to cover their tracks, because they know that, it's well publicized now that that before the assault team left the compound in Pakistan, that they swept up computers, computer hard drives, files, paperwork, pocket litter, as it's called, documentary evidence and so forth can be used to develop intelligence for follow-on raids. And U.S. counterterrorism forces are attempting to process this information as rapidly as possible so that they can quickly execute follow-on raids before the al-Qaeda leadership can cover their tracks and find alternative hide locations.
It must be something for those people to look at what's on those computers after all of these years, to look at the inner workings of al-Qaeda and bin Laden's files. It must be an extraordinary thing for them to be doing right now, isn't it?
Well, it could be. It really depends upon what measures bin Laden and his personal circle there at the compound in Pakistan, what measures they took regarding their own internal security. It's interesting that bin Laden personally did not have a larger security detail than he did. I know he had to weigh the risks of that. If he had a large security detail, then that would give off a signature, making him more easily found. As it happens, the raiding party, the assault team, had very little opposition because there wasn't much of a security detail. But similarly, with respect to the data trove there, we'll know, I guess, in the weeks and months ahead what measures, if any, bin Laden took to protect al-Qaeda's secrets in case of an event that happened 2 days ago.
Mm-hmm. And what about the threat that we face now? There's been, a little bit of uneasiness in parts of the country that, and some people have said a retaliatory strike is inevitable here. Others are not so sure. What are your thoughts?
Well, my observations, and this is just my personal observations, is that it seems as if al-Qaeda has been on a steep decline in its capabilities and professionalism over the past 7-8 years or so. What plots have come our way seem to be diminishing in their professionalism, in their preparation. They seem to be getting more and more amateurish. They still have an obsession with airliners and airports, and our Department of Homeland Security and other domestic counterterrorism agencies are well aware of that. I think it shows that our campaign to suppress al-Qaeda and its affiliates and like-minded terrorist organizations over the past decade seems to be winning this war of attrition and making the border security better, much better than it was a decade ago.
We welcome phone calls, and here's how you reach us. 800-486-8655. Robert Haddock is our guest, managing editor of Small Wars Journal. He also writes This Week at War column for Foreign Policy magazine. The email address, talk@wpr.org. And again, the number, 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We welcome phone calls now, 800-486-8655. Phil in Madison, our first caller. Hi, Phil.
Hi. I have a couple short questions. I know you mentioned that you didn't expect necessarily a retaliatory strike just because there may be some fracturing within the al-Qaeda. Honestly, with what we've seen from Osama bin Laden over the last 10 years, I wouldn't be surprised if he had put together some sort of a contingency plan for al-Qaeda. If I'm killed, then let's do this right away, just to kind of, I mean, do you think that this would be more, his disappearance would be more troubling for al-Qaeda because they don't know who to turn to now, or for us because we're not really sure who's in charge in case something else does happen? We're not really sure where it's coming from. And the second question is, what are the chances that now with our number one target gone, we might see a restructuring in the war on terror since, I mean, terror is, it's an idea. You can't identify individuals in a war on terror, and so it's something that it's difficult to say what the objectives are there. Is it possible we could see a restructuring so that it's a more clearly defined end game for us?
Yes, well, those are two great questions. On your first question, I think the Department of Homeland Security, state and local law enforcement, and so forth, I think that they transitioned away from a Bin Laden-centric sort of counter-terrorism defense strategy a long time ago, and they are preparing for defending against terrorist threats from a generalized perspective. In other words, terrorism could come, terrorist attacks in the United States could come from a wide variety of sources, not just Al-Qaeda or not just from Bin Laden Central in Pakistan. So I think they're already prepared for the post Bin Laden era of terrorism threats. Now, to your second question about what is the future of the U.S. campaign, sort of offensive campaign in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, elsewhere around the world in counterterrorism, I think that there will be a lot of thinking among policymakers about where this goes next. I think that it may be more difficult to sustain support for the counterinsurgency hearts and minds campaign that the U.S. is trying to pursue in Afghanistan right now. You know, the counterterrorism approach had a great victory 2 days ago. A lot of people will say, well, why don't we just keep doing that? And why do we have to keep going with the counterinsurgency campaign in Afghanistan?
So that's going to
be a great subject of discussion here in Washington in the period ahead.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Phil, very much for your call. Let's go next to Jim in Milwaukee. Hi.
Oh, hi. I'd like to make a comment and a question sort of similar to what's been already talked about. Instead of celebrating the apparent killing of Bin Laden, I think actually this is a time for great remorse because I think it underscores the devaluation of lives of people who are not Americans. After all, Bin Laden was killed by police work, by undercover work. He wasn't killed by an invasion and occupation. And the invasions and occupations that followed 9/11 were in crimes in their own sense. Hundreds of thousands of people were casualties, unjust casualties. And instead of just focusing on capturing this criminal or killing this criminal, we should also be focusing on the crimes that were committed as our response to 9/11, the deaths of all these innocent people. And both Americans and as well as people who live in those countries, deaths that should not have occurred.
Yeah, but we just killed him, so we got to focus on this. It was a fairly major event. I understand what you're saying, but we have to take in what just happened.
We do not fight terrorism with invasions and occupations, but instead use police work to do that.
All right. Well, I think that you said that we're going to be examining that more as a result of this, that this was very effective. Do you want to elaborate on that, Robert? Who's going to bring up the idea that we need to do more of these kinds of operations?
Well, there'll be discussions on Capitol Hill and elsewhere in the policy community here in Washington about what course the U.S. Should take from here forward. In order to have an effective counterterrorism program to do the kinds of things that was done at this compound in Pakistan 2 days ago, for example, you need two things. First, you need this investigative or intelligence gathering capability for manhunting, to find a particular person at a particular location at a particular time. Bin Laden was a very hard target. He took extraordinary measures to protect his is security in that regard. But the CIA, with a lot of painstaking work, was able to crack the case. So if they can do it with Bin Laden,
right,
they can do it with probably just about anybody. And then the second thing that you need is you need the hammer. You need direct action assault capability, and the Joint Special Operations Command has demonstrated that it can go just about anywhere in the world to do that. So now with these capabilities having been proven in this mm-hmm. Sense against probably the most challenging target, there'll be a lot of discussion in Washington as to why that shouldn't be done more, and counterinsurgency like we're doing in the villages in Afghanistan, done less.
Yeah. You know, and Jim makes a strong point, too, when you think about the war and the hundreds of thousands of people who died in Iraq and how effective that was. And there's been a lot of question about Afghanistan as well, that we don't seem to see an end game. We don't seem to see very much success. A lot of innocent people died in this war on terror. Wasn't there a better way to go? It's a legitimate question.
That's right. And that those will be the intensity of that, of those questions, I think, is going to only rise now with the death of Bin Laden.
Yeah. Let's go. Thank you, Jim, for your call. Kesser is next in Germantown. Hi, Kesser.
Yes, I have a comment and a question. If I was the president of Pakistan, I would tell the Americans, I am sleeping. Go do your dirty job and take him dead or alive, because if they had captured him, if the Pakistani security forces were there, they would have to keep in Pakistan, do the paperwork or to bring him out. Or if he was dead, let's say if he had died, there's no way the Pakistani government would be able to allow him to go, because once he's dead, according to the Islamic laws, he has paid for his crimes, and then he has to be buried, according to the proper Islamic rituals. So nobody wanted that man's body in their country, because they don't want to make a martyr and a shrine. Secondly, do you think, and this is a question for the guest, do you think that if Al-Qaeda had a strong lobby, a lobbyist organization in the U.S., just the way the Saudis and the Israelis have strong lobbies and they can do whatever atrocities on their people, do you think they would have been spared a little bit more? And this is like a very sarcastic question. Do you think they would have been spared a little bit more? I mean, we would have given them a little bit more opportunity to reform themselves, because Saudis and the Israelis, what they're doing to their people, including Pakistan and a lot of other Muslim countries, we put money in the coffins of these people.
All right, let's get a response. Robert.
Well, yes, I'm not... I know it's a somewhat sarcastic question. The United States government is still most comfortable working with other nation states who have official recognition and embassies and so forth, and there's always a great deal of debate in policy circles in Washington and elsewhere about how much the U.S. government should or should not be dealing with unsavory regimes of various gradations, and that debate has gone on for 200 years in the history of this country, and it'll continue to go on in the future.
Yeah. Just a couple of final questions. And we were talking to Ron Susskind, who did, all these books on particularly the Bush administration conduct on the war on terror. But he said that we were paying Pakistan $1 billion a year. And essentially the money was to go to get Bin Laden. What the heck was that all about? $1 billion and you just look askance?
Right. Well, yes, the U.S. has a very difficult relationship with Pakistan.
Yeah.
The U.S. government is dependent upon the Pakistani government, in order to maintain the U.S. NATO war effort in Afghanistan, because Afghanistan is a landlocked country. All the supplies, and it's hundreds of trucks a day, to supply that war effort in Afghanistan, probably 60% of the supplies have to go through Pakistani territory to get to U.S. bases in Afghanistan. And so as long as the U.S. Wants to continue its military campaign in Afghanistan, it's going to need the cooperation of Pakistan to do that.
Yeah, and finally, there will be, and you can just hear this coming, because there was a lot of concern about interrogation techniques that have been used around the world where these people have been held, and at Guantanamo. What's your best information here about how the information was gathered? Was it because of pretty harsh interrogation techniques at Guantanamo and other places, or was it these Pakistanis who were CIA agents?
Well, yes, John Brennan, President Obama's counterterrorism advisor, discussed this yesterday at his press conference and today. He said that, I'm kind of paraphrasing his words, sort of like any other police investigation or intelligence case, discovery of the bin Laden compound was a mosaic of bits of information that were pieced together painstakingly over time, and they came from a variety of sources, including interrogations. Now, whether these were the harsh interrogations, extraordinary interrogation techniques from the first Bush term, how much of the information came from those, I think that's kind of a mystery at this point. But I think the larger question is that capturing people on the battlefield instead of killing them with drone strikes is still important. Interrogations are important. Human intelligence sources are important, and we wouldn't have been able to get bin Laden had we not been able to interrogate captures from the battlefield.
Thank you, Robert, very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Robert Haddock, he's managing editor of Small Wars Journal. You can find them online at smallwarsjournal.com. Also writes the This Week at War column for Foreign Policy magazine. Joining us now, Mary Habeck, associate professor in the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. She is the author of the forthcoming book, Attacking America, How Al-Qaeda is Fighting Their 200-Year War with the U.S. Knowing the Enemy, Jihadist Ideology and the War on Terror, another of her books, Storm of Steel, The Development of Armor Doctrine in Germany and the Soviet Union, 1919 to 1939, Spain Betrayed, the Soviet Union in the Spanish Civil War, and co-editor of The Great War and the 20th Century. She has written for foreignpolicy.com an article, Ding Dong, The Witch is Dead, Now What? Shadow Government is the name of her piece. And we thank you very much, Mary. Her special expertise is in American defense policy and irregular warfare, Islamic religion, culture and law, military history, military power and strategy. And she is an associate professor of strategic studies at Johns Hopkins University. Professor Habeck, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
There's good reason, you wrote recently, to hope that the coalition that constitutes much of the global jihad will begin to unravel as individual leaders are able to reconsider their oath that they would make to bin Laden. Tell me more about that. What's the oath they make, and how are they possibly unraveling?
The oath of fealty that many leaders of jihadist groups have made is called Bay'ah. And basically, it's a sort of medieval concept that you are swearing personally to hear and obey everything that the commander tells you to do. The commander, the word that's usually used is amir in Arabic, tells you to do. So as long as it doesn't contradict Islamic law. And this oath binds you until death do you part. So many leaders of jihadist groups around the world took a look at al-Qaeda during the 1990s and thought, this is the weak horse, and they refused to join up with it. And they also didn't agree with their concept of attacking America. They were more concerned about local conditions and the failures of their own governments and wanted to do something about changing them. But after 9/11, there was a huge crackdown on these groups, encouraged by the United States. And many of the groups were whittled down in size to only a few dozen or a few hundred guys. And sort of one of the reasons that they took a second look at bin Laden was, well, at least they're doing something, you know, and our group is falling apart, and we haven't accomplished anything. And so a lot of local jihadist groups swore bayat personally to bin Laden as their commander. But then, as I said, this oath is only binding until death. So with the death of bin Laden, it doesn't automatically transfer to his deputy.
I see.
So they have an opportunity now to rethink that commitment to al-Qaeda. And if al-Qaeda is incapable of carrying out the grandiose plans that they have been talking about, once al-Qaeda's Shura Council has decided on a new leader for the group, they'll be able to reconsider. Do we want to, you know, join up with these guys again, or do we want to pursue other means for change?
Hmm. And this this new guy, is it not al-Zawahiri?
Well, there was actually a piece in a Pakistani newspaper by a guy named Shahzad, who's a has some fantastic contacts, apparently, with jihadist groups in Pakistan. And he asserted that the Shura Council had appointed Zawahiri as a sort of temporary leader, but that they were going to have some sort of big meeting and come up with a someone else. And I actually think that for their purposes, Zawahiri is a poor choice because he has a lot of baggage from his days in Egypt and a lot of arguments and fights that he had with people that probably al-Qaeda wants to reach out to now.
Mm-hmm. And when you write in your piece that some who supported bin Laden will decide not to transfer their loyalty, they might be open to surrendering or negotiations. To whom would they surrender and who are they conducting negotiations with? And what would be the substance of those?
Well, when I think about negotiations, I was thinking specifically about the Taliban, who have been already splintered, and there are various groups within the Taliban that might now be open even more so to negotiations with the U.S. And when I thought about those who might, you know, sort of surrender or just, you know, sort of give up on it, there are actually a whole coalition of groups that have come together to create what's called al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, which is the group in North Africa. And some of them have been pummeled rather badly by the Algerians and others. And they might be open to coming to some sort of terms with those governments.
Here's something you say that a lot of people believe, but you back it up with your great scholarship in this area. There is no way in God's green earth that some part of official Pakistan, the military, the intelligence agencies, or the political class was not somehow involved in protecting bin Laden from detection and capture. Punishing Pakistan is not the point, but rather that the country is much further along in its slide toward extremism and perhaps even civil war. And then you suggest that it needs more, not less, assistance from us. Well, there's a lot in that, so take it on.
Well, first of all, the place where bin Laden was found, Abbottabad, is a sort of mid-sized city that is the kind of retirement capital for lots of people in the military. And it also has a large military base there. It's a headquarters for one of the brigades. For the for a division in the Pakistani military, it has the equivalent of West Point, our West Point there, their main military academy, and his house was built right down the street from a large police station. So this was not done, you know, next to some cave in the middle of nowhere,
right,
you know,
right.
The wilds of nowhere. So somebody had to approve the plans for building that house. Somebody had to approve the contractors coming in and putting in all this stuff. Somebody had to turn a blind eye when they had all these strange comings and goings in the night that the neighbors talk about. You know, there was something going on, some sort of corruption, or there was some sort of complicity in the building and ignoring of this huge compound.
And so what does that mean for how Pakistan has been co-opted by these extremist groups and what it portends for perhaps an upcoming civil war here? How deep are the animosities and how close is potential civil war?
Well, first of all, just on the rise of extremism in Pakistan, the murder of prominent politicians and judges who have dared to express opinions that contradict the ideas of the extremists, the targeted killings that have occurred over the past 3 or 4 years, especially in Karachi.
Mm.
The bombings that have taken out hundreds of military people in their strongest, you know, center, the kind of their pentagon of Rawalpindi, the murders of all sorts of prominent people without any clue as to who did it. I'm thinking here especially of Benazir Bhutto, who was assassinated, and there has been this steady drum of and rise of violence in Pakistan that we in the U.S. have been able to ignore because it hasn't directly affected us yet.
Mm-hmm.
But the country is bit by bit, the northern section of the country has been taken over by extremists. Their version of Islamic law has been imposed on people whether they wanted it or not. And they have slowly been moving out of that territory into other places like Karachi and even, you know, set up a mosque inside of Islamabad itself that is imposing their concepts. So I feel like there's this slow slide. No, it was also, by the way, the inability of the Pakistani military to completely quell this. And I don't think it's from lack of trying. I give them full marks, in fact, for attempting to put down this violence. When SWAT, for instance, which was always described as Pakistan's Switzerland, fell to the militants, the Pakistani military immediately, you know, made plans, went in there, and attempted to quash it. But no sooner had they left when the militants returned. So they've got a serious insurgency in their own country that they're dealing with. And so far, bit by bit, their country is falling to the extremists. It's not being reversed in the way they hoped. And the kinds of tactics they're using kind of go in and smack the insurgents around and then leave, or leave a few troops there but not enough to actually, you know, hold the ground, is so far proving ineffective. So that's the worry. And then places like Karachi, where there were all these targeted killings on many sides, but at least some of the killings were carried out by extremists, and then there was retaliation and back and forth. I unfortunately, that sort of violence could grow to kind of dominate the country, and that's a huge worry, that mm-hmm. if that kind of sectarian and ideological fights that have turned to violence sort of engulf the country, that's what one worries about.
Mm. When you say, though, that what they need is more rather than less assistance from us, it strikes me that this country is not hardly going to be in the mood to give them much of anything. We're probably pretty mad at them at this point in time. What kind of assistance are you talking about? They've already had tons of money to help us track Bin Laden, and we see how far that got us. They didn't do anything. I don't know where all the money went. What kind of assistance could we possibly give them now that we would agree to give them that would be effective?
Right. When I say assistance, I actually wasn't thinking so much of money. Instead, I meant the sort of advice that our military can give them about how to deal with their insurgency problem. So my model for thinking about this is actually a communist insurgency in the Philippines that the U.S. Fought with the Filipinos back in the 1940s and 50s and won. In fact, the U.S. fought three separate insurgencies in the Philippines and won all three of them in the 20th century. And this third one was actually not the most difficult of the three, in my opinion. It was sort of the second most difficult. But how it was fought and won, I think, can be sort of a model for how we think about Pakistan, because the Philippines have very strict rules about foreign troops on their territory. So they weren't going to ask the U.S. to send over a few divisions to take on the insurgents and kind of get rid of them like the Vietnamese would do later. Instead, the U.S. sent over a few dozen advisors who helped the Filipinos to reform their military and their police force and took on and defeated the insurgents within just about five to 6 years. So that's the kind of assistance that I'm thinking of. Now, it makes several assumptions. First of all, that the Pakistanis would be willing and open to this kind of advice. Secondly, that the country is not so far gone that it'll actually make a difference. But, you know, given those two assumptions, I don't think that there's much else that we can be doing. Money certainly isn't going to fix this problem.
We welcome phone calls for our guest. Our number is 800-486-8655. Professor Mary Habeck is Associate Professor of Strategic Studies at Johns Hopkins University, author of the forthcoming Attacking America, How Al-Qaeda is Fighting Their 200-Year War with the U.S., also author of Knowing the Enemy, Jihadist Ideology, and the War on Terror, and a number of other books. Lines are open if you'd like to join the conversation, 800-486-8655, and our email is talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Mike from Appleton, you're on the air.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Hi.
A little controversial, but bear with me. This country has had 400 years of a war, and what I'm talking about is the war against greed. The early pioneers basically stole the lands from the Native Americans. We also brought in slavery to create wealth for the elite plantation owners, and then we built our railroads on immigrant labor. So my point is this whole idea of very wealthy individuals, such as Osama bin Laden, who would have never been able to capture the hearts and souls without the millions of dollars that he funded, can also be a lesson for today that wealth within the wrong hands can create much chaos, not just in the Middle East, but in this country as well. So that's the lesson here is that unbridled wealth without a strong government to battle against potential corruption and greed. Madoff is not an example, but if he decided to use his money for evil, he could have done it. So I guess the point is that we need to balance capitalism with justice and social ideals and not allow wealth to destroy not just the Middle East, but also this country.
Professor?
Well, I guess I have several reactions to that. The first is that bin Laden, as we all know, was born to a very wealthy man. Of course, he was the 19th child of 50-some children. But his inheritance, everybody assumes, was somewhere around $100 million, maybe more, maybe less. But by the time he got to Afghanistan, I think pretty much everybody agrees he had actually spent all of his money on accomplishing what he thought were very good goals. His goals were to revive his community, to protect his land from what he thought was occupation. He spent a lot of money in Sudan, buying up land and making it into very fertile farming areas and building roads and all sorts of things, actually, for the Sudanese. So he had basically spent his money by the time he got to Afghanistan in 1996. and in fact wins a lot of props from some people, at least in the Muslim community, for foregoing his wealth and giving it up in order to live a life of austerity, a very ascetic life, at least originally in Afghanistan. You know, they kind of look around their own countries, and you have a lot of oil wealth, and people kind of, you know, feel free to spend their money on themselves and their families and live in very nice, comfortable homes and everything. And in fact, his oldest son rejected the life that his dad had because he wanted to go back to Saudi Arabia and enjoy that kind of life. So it's not quite true that bin Laden was living it up the entire time he was on the run. And instead, he had basically given his money away or used it in pursuit of what he thought, at least, were worthwhile goals. But then, once the fight against the United States began in earnest after 9/11, he obviously found some other funding streams and people willing to support him and donate money for the cause. And like other great leaders, or charismatic leaders at least, of causes, he was able to, you know, get some pretty pretty good funding for himself, and then use that money to probably fund violence in pursuit of his cause around the world. So he was a wealthy person, but he gave up that wealth in pursuit of what he believed was justice. He defined it as justice.
Thank you, Mike, for the call. Peter in Madison is next. Hi, Peter.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call, Kathleen. I just turned on my car at the moment. Your guest from Johns Hopkins made a statement about the nature of the American activity in the Philippines. I presume that was regarding the Moro insurgency?
No, actually it was the Hukbalahap.
In the 19-teens under William Howard Taft and...
No. The 1940s and 50s.
Oh, okay. Then I misunderstood what you were talking about. Our earlier activities in the Philippines were not an advisor to a democratic country type of a role at all.
No, not at all. That was, in fact, one of the earlier insurgencies that I mentioned previously.
Thank you, Peter, very much for the call. Good to get cleared. If you're just tuning in, it's okay to get cleared up here. Richard in Madison, hi.
Hello. I was calling in reference to the possibility that the compound where bin Laden was held up at, because he had been on the run for 10 years, that it wasn't actually set up to lure him out to a location where he could be taken, because he had been held up in the mountains in the rat holes where they couldn't get him out for years and years, and complacency may have been the best bet in capturing bin Laden one way or another. And your comment, I'll take off the air.
My reaction to that is that I find the timing of his of the building of this place quite significant. It was built in 2005, and he probably moved into it sometime in 2005 or 2006. At least that's the stuff that I've seen out there talking about this. That was right at a moment when Al-Qaeda was making a comeback around the world. Up until that point, they had pretty much been on the run. And I think that the group would have shattered and perhaps beyond all recognition if bin Laden had been caught in 2004. But because of Iraq and the rebuilding of Al-Qaeda there, and also this is when, by the way, he begins to take bayat from other groups in other parts of the world. I think that what happened is he found himself in a position where he had to have more contact with the outside world than he could have from wherever he was before this. And the way that this place was constructed, I've spoken with some people about the raid itself and, you know, what this looked like. It was basically a command and control center with, you know, fantastic links to the outside world in order to keep in touch with his global jihad. So I think that actually the timing had more to do with a need for greater contact with the outside world.
How did he keep in touch? There was no internet, no television, from what I read.
I actually read something that disputed that.
Really?
That said that there was, but that it was some sort of point-to-point thing that kind of kept it off of any kind of bigger grid.
Oh, I see. Well, you're fascinating. Please join us again. I'd love to talk to you at greater length. Thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Our guest this half hour, Professor Mary Habeck, Associate Professor, School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. We also thank Robert Haddock, Managing Editor of Small Wars Journal, who writes This Week at War for Foreign Policy Magazine. Well, that was a worthwhile 2 hours, wasn't it? I just feel like we're so much better informed in looking at continuing issues now, which is what we hope to do with these kinds of in-depth shows. Thanks very much to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing on air, and for both of them for putting together the whole 2 hours. And thanks for your calls, everybody. Tomorrow we'll broadcast from Madison, kind of a rare occurrence, for our one-day pledge drive. So please join us. We'll have good guests and good shows.